Welcome back to Question Medicine 2018. Oh my goodness, it's been so long since the last podcast. Just haven't got out there, been busy with the move, been busy with all kinds of different things in life. But now I am back ready for action. Got the studio all set up, ready to rock and roll. With that being said, I'm going to try and release at least one podcast a week again for the next little bit. There are so many papers to talk about. I'm so far behind in the literature. I mean, really, at this rate, I think I could release probably one podcast a day for the next month and still be pretty far behind in all the stacks of literature I've built up to two podcasts about. I've already read the articles. All I gotta do is podcast about them, and I'm pretty far behind. So, without further ado, let's get this thing going. Let's kick it off without any hesitation, no further reservations. Here we go. Question Medicine 2018. All right, welcome back again. 2018 Question Medicine. I am Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. We're going to do this one a little differently. I'm going to talk about something that I think needs to be talked about. It's kind of actually a topic, maybe a little deep dive. And then the last part of this, we're going to dig into three articles that Joe and I covered on Paper Chase. But if you're listening to it here first, you're hearing it 2 months in advance because we don't, production and all that stuff. But again, if you have any questions, if you have any articles that you want to read yourself, you want to dig into the literature yourself, just email me at andrewbilt@gmail.com or find me on Twitter, probably easiest, at andrewbilt. And pretty much all these articles I tweet out before I talk about them. So if you want to get an inside scoop on what I'm reading before I read it, even some of the things I don't podcast about, I usually tweet about. So check there first. All right. A topic that I think needs to be talked about is ACE inhibitors. Yes, ACE inhibitors. Lisinopril, that's probably the main one that most people write for, but I think we all write for them, and we all love them, or at least I think we all love them. But ACE inhibitors have an ugly side. We know that ACE inhibitors have an ugly side. It comes in the form of one of two things, either A, a cough, or B, probably the worst of all, angioedema. What is angioedema? Well, it can be defined as an asymptomatic, non-pitting swelling of the subcutaneous or submucosal tissue that most commonly affects non-dependent areas. This may not be a big deal if we're talking about like the upper thigh or something like that. However, when it affects or causes laryngeal edema, that's when we have an issue. When you have the inspiratory stridor, that's a big deal. And how often does this happen? Well, I think it happens more often than we all would think. In fact, if I had to ask you to guess what is the number needed to harm, what would you say? If I had to ask you, guess right now, you're driving your car, what is the number needed to harm? If you said it depends, then you'd be right. The answer is it depends. It depends on what study you read. There's a paper from 1998 titled ACE Inhibitor-Induced Angioedema Incidence Prevention and Management, and in that we're looking at angioedema rates low, 0.1 to 0.2. 0.1 to 0.2, we're looking at 1 in 1,000, 1 in 500. If you go to the OCTIV trial, American Journal of Hypertension, 2004, that was with 40 of enalapril once daily, we're looking at angioedema rates around 1 in 200. That's significantly more. What's the right answer? I don't think anyone really knows. It probably goes up with dose. It probably maybe depends on which one. But the answer is it's more frequent than what you think. And if you give these enough over the course of your career, you personally, you listening to this, will cause one case of angioedema. I can almost guarantee you individually. And if depending on your patient population, you may cause more than one case of angioedema. And when angioedema happens, I think we all know what to do. You stop the ACE inhibitor. But the interesting thing that I learned when researching this topic was that even if the ACE inhibitor is not discontinued, the angioedema will still resolve. I mean, that was mind-blowing. I thought you had to stop the drug. Turns out you do not at all. It's still going to resolve. Now, why does it resolve? We don't really know. or at least we don't fully understand the mechanism, but it has to do something with angioedema, increased levels of bradykinin, and that's really all you need to know because that's all the board questions are going to ask. There was a paper titled Plasma Bradykinin and Angioedema. This is Lancet 98, and they looked at what were the bradykinin levels during an episode of angioedema due to an ACE inhibitor. And then when they looked at it, they drew the blood levels. Turns out, 10-fold increase in bradykinin levels. And maybe one of the other fascinating pieces about this angioedema is that even if you stop the ACE inhibitor, the patient can still have an episode, or a second episode, a recurrent episode of angioedema 1 to 2 weeks after the initial episode. So then it brings up the question of, well, they can't be on an ACE inhibitor, but what do? I still kind of want this kidney protection, although as I've talked about before on multiple podcasts, the kidney protection is really kidney protection with proteinuria. It's not kidney protection with decreased rates of end-stage dialysis or decreased rates of just kidney function. It's just proteinuria. And as much as having protein in your urine is an important outcome, it's an important endpoint that we all strive for, none of my patients care about their proteinuria. Not one, all but none care about the proteinuria. So what do? But you say, I want something that kind of works in the kidneys and the ACE inhibitor is working so well for them. Can I give them an ARB? The good old angiotensin II receptor blockers. Can I give them an ARB? And the answer is yes. Yes, you can. You may think I should stay away from this pathway, this renin-angiotensin blocker pathway that we had to all memorize in medical school. But have no fear and prescribe away. Here is a fun little fact for you. A fun paper, if you will. This was a paper titled A Meta-Analysis of Randomized Trials of Angioedema as an Adverse Event of Renin-Angiotensin System Inhibitors. This is an American Journal of Cardiology 2012, and this looked at just over 35,000 patients. And ready for this? The overall incidence of angioedema with an ARB was no different than it was with placebo, which is great news. ARBs don't give you angioedema. It just doesn't really happen. If it does happen, it's not more common than placebo. And when it's not better or worse than placebo, that's about as good as we're going to get in medicine. So, before we get into Joe and I's quick discussion on the three main articles that he covered for Paper Chase, there's one thing that I think needs to be brought up, and that is we all of us, need to stop prescribing so many ACE inhibitors and start with more ARBs. And by start with more ARBs, I mean basically, let's only write for ARBs. Because as we just said, the rates of angioedema, no difference. We know that the cough, significantly less. I'm not even going to talk about that. And then you might be saying, well, what about the cost? I have no interest in Walmart pharmacy whatsoever, but both an ACE inhibitor and an ARB are $4 at Walmart. There's no difference in cost. So if we have no difference in cost, we have a difference in benefit for the numbers needed to harm, we must be saying, well, what about the number needed to treat? Again, the kidney thing, I'm not even going to touch on it because it's not really a thing for the patient-oriented outcomes that we really want. And you might be saying, but Andrew, I know that we have to give an ACE inhibitor. We have to give an ACE inhibitor because ACE inhibitors they're just better for cardiovascular events. And the reason that you say that, whether you know it or not, it's based on a trial 18 years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine titled Effects of Angiotensin Converting Enzyme Inhibitor Ramipril on Cardiovascular Events in High-Risk Patients. The clinical question here was, in patients with multiple cardiovascular risk factors, does ramipril reduce cardiovascular morbidity and mortality? And the bottom line was that ramipril reduces rates of death, MI, and stroke among patients with multiple cardiovascular risk factors and without heart failure. And this was huge. Because, as far as I'm aware, this was the first time that ACE inhibitors had a clear indication for individuals with multiple cardiovascular risk factors and preserved systolic function. Prior to that, in the consensus and the solved and the saved trial, we had seen enalapril, an ACE inhibitor, did show benefit in hospitalized patients in reducing mortality. But again, that's with reduced systolic function. This was with preserved, and we all thought, oh my goodness, this is it. The trial was actually stopped early when ramipril demonstrated a significant reduction in primary endpoint of MI stroke and cardiovascular death compared to placebo with a number needed to treat of 27. Once we had this, ramipril, which is an ACE inhibitor, it then just became instinct that we say, boom, ACE inhibitor. That's what we're going to give. But now there's new evidence out. And when the new evidence comes in, like the tide, we must roll out like the water. Or at least if we're going to use it, we got to roll. We got to go with it. So here we go. The new evidence just out in JACC, the Journal of American College of Cardiology. Paper, angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitors in hypertension to use or not to use. This took 111 randomized clinical trials of ACE inhibitors and ARBs in more than 500,000 patients and found no difference, zero difference, zilcho differencio in efficacy between the two drug classes with regard to the surrogate endpoint of blood pressure and the outcomes of all-cause mortality, cardiovascular mortality, myocardial infarction, heart failure, stroke, and end-stage renal disease. So let's sum it all up. As I've already mentioned, when it comes to ACE inhibitors, the harm is somewhere in the realm of 1 in 200 to 1 in 1,000 for angioedema. That's not even talking, not even hitting on that little annoying dry cough that they get. And there is little to any clinical benefit for an ACE inhibitor over an ARB. And there's likely, for sure, more harm with an ACE inhibitor over an ARB. So hopefully when you go to the office tomorrow, you'll start doing some drug ectomies on the ACE inhibitors, start throwing in some ARBs, or if you're just going to write for a new medication right now, hey, you need to be starting a blood pressure medication, you start to, with the ARB. You kick it off for the right off the bat with the ARB because the benefit is just there. There's no reason not to at this point. Now, let's kick it off. Joe and I talking about three articles. I'm going to interject at a few different spots in there. We're so far ahead of the curve on this one that just today, June 25th, the FDA is finally catching up to what we were saying just earlier this month. And if you listen to Primary Care Wrap, you will hear it in September, but if you listen to Questioning Medicine, you're hearing it now. So here we go. Joe, true or false, we just recorded Paper Chase.
True. Ding, you are a winner.
True or false, this was your month to pick three papers that you really liked.
Truth also, double dinger. What have we got for him, Johnny?
All right, here's what we have for you. I want you to tell me a little bit about it. Vitamin D supplementation on recurrent wheezing in black infants born preterm. That's first of all, that seems pretty narrow, recurrent, black, and preterm. Come on. And then we're checking the vitamin D levels. It's a randomized trial, JAMA, May 29, 2018. What's the deal here?
So interesting. They basically said if we give babies 400 IUs that are born preterm and then we follow how often they wheeze. And the reason they picked black infants is because they're at the highest risk for recurrent wheezing of all preterm infants. So we looked to see if supplementation on breastfed or formula fed without supplementation, in other words, not paying attention to how much they get, made a difference, and it looked like the consistent supplementation along with breastfeeding gave us about a 10% reduction in recurrent wheezing in these preterm black infants.
But I'm going to ask a ridiculous question. I don't deal with a lot of infants. Is wheezing that big of a deal?
Yes, it is. It's a super common problem. I would say return to clinic, return to maybe an urgent care or hospital. It's probably in the top five or six newborn concerns, or maybe even one of the reasons why I would say we don't discharge more from the newborn nursery or the don't transfer from NICU, depending on how early they were born, down to the regular nursery as breathing difficulty or wheezing.
All right, deal. How will this change your practice, or will this change your practice?
Well, I think it just we've already been trying to ensure 400 IUs per day of vitamin D in all kids. that aren't getting it from formula. What I think this reaffirms is that breastfeeding plus supplementation wins the day in almost every study we do versus formula, even if they tell you there's at least 400 IUs per day of this formula. Whether it's a colicky baby, I don't know, whatever, and the fact that we've got that vitamin D concentrated, so they only have to give one big gulp to get it all down, maybe that's part of the benefit. And maybe this study kind of had a bias where it didn't consider the benefits of breastfeeding on wheezing. I don't know. But yeah, I'm going to keep encouraging the current guidelines of vitamin D in kids.
All right, I'm digging it. So, true or false, we're on to article number two.
That is true.
All right, the next one, you're digging the pregnant women and kids and the newborn. And the next one, you're looking at glyburide versus insulin in the perinatal complications among women with gestational diabetes. This is a randomized clinical trial. Again, we're looking at JAMA, May 1st. So, I mean, what's the deal here? Tell me more.
So interesting. So we were looking to avoid the needle and the finger sticks associated with insulin for these gestational diabetic women. We wanted to know because we have problems with macrosomia, neonatal hypoglycemia from most drugs. And so that's why we avoid them. And we go back to insulin because it doesn't cross the placenta. Interesting part of this trial is this drug that does cross the placenta caused more problems than insulin, and we already don't love insulin. But we can't increase the risk of high-risk features to this gestational diabetic pregnancy. We can't increase the risk. So glyburide essentially lost the battle, can't be recommended over insulin because it increases high-risk features. Man, we need some help here. We need these kids to have a chance because insulin was the dirty dog in this study. Insulin wasn't much better than this drug. We all say, oh, but insulin's so safe, it doesn't cross the placenta. But in reality, it barely beat this straw man argument. It barely beat a drug we rarely use in adults. Well, I don't know why they thought the outcomes would be better. We don't have that ASCVD risk reduction. We don't have that neonatal high-risk feature reducing diabetic therapy. We just don't have it. Insulin didn't do well. Glyburide did worse. Somebody had to
Didn't you think? I just thought glyburide actually would succeed. I don't know why. Yeah. I wanted it to succeed.
Well, compliance. Right? I mean, it's not a shot.
Right? Yes.
They just take a pill. I'm good. But again, they didn't even... This is done in France, and they didn't dose it the same as we would. They weren't very aggressive, and there wasn't a protocol. So I think there's some room to improve.
What do you mean they weren't aggressive?
Well, I mean, they started at the lowest dose, and almost the average dose didn't exceed the next dose. So almost nobody went. They started at the lowest dose of 2.5 milligrams, and almost nobody got off of it for the whole trial. And I'm like, come on. Who treats anybody with 2.5 when their sugars are still up? And again, this study had lots of features to it. It was a good study, but it just has lots of room to go where we can say, don't compare insulin, which we all know is a dog, but has a lot of safe features and a lot of things that it can do, to something like glyburide. We need a next generation kind of sexier drug that doesn't cross the placenta, that doesn't cause neonatal hypoglycemia, but that can reverse some of the outcomes like macrosomia. That's what we need.
I wish. Do you think that drug's out there?
No, it's currently? For sure not out there. It's for sure it's not. And if it is, we don't know it. Like if it's one of these SGLTs, maybe a comeback from canagliflozin, maybe it can come back in the pediatric population or the neonatal, the gestational diabetic woman. Maybe it can find a niche where it's better than others for some reason.
Yeah. But right, we're never going to have that trial. Like, oh, I know. Don't worry. You're right. We cut your toes off in normal adults. Let me go ahead and try this
come on.
The unborn fetus.
Bad. It was just amputations. Come on.
Yeah, let me.
Every mom's
going to
enroll their unborn child in a study with a drug that causes amputation. When they hear the word amputations, the dad's going to escort you out of the room.
All right. As Joe and I said in that last paper, you know, there's just not a lot of good evidence on pregnancy, because who wants to give their wife, their pregnant wife, and their unborn fetus a drug that really hasn't been studied? So to get new trials is pretty difficult. However, right as I was about to release this, I did find a paper titled Metformin Exposure in First Trimester of Pregnancy and Risk of All or Specific Congenital Abnormalities, an Exploratory Case Control Study. Basically, this looked at a huge registry from Europe. It looked at over 1 million births. Then it looked at the abnormalities. And then it looked at, within the abnormalities, how many of those had metformin exposure. The good news is that no evidence was found for an increased risk of all non-genetic congenital abnormalities combined following exposure to metformin during the first trimester. Again, this is far from a randomized controlled trial. However, I think, you know, maybe metformin is safe, but is metformin going to be any better than insulin? I don't know about that. Or at least, you know, not the studies I've seen. If you have them, again, tweet me, email me, let me know. I would be more than happy to read them. Next is my favorite paper. I'm not going to go too much into it, but right as I was about to release this, the FDA came out and said, guess what? We are going to go ahead and release the first ever, for the first time in the Americas, a marijuana drug. It's actually a cannabidiol drug or CBD drug, but it'll reduce the risk of seizures. I have no idea on the legalities of this drug. I have no idea on the cost of this drug. All I know is when we go by this trial, this drug seems to work. This drug seems to work for the Lennox-Gastaut seizures. The drug is going to go by the brand name Epidulox. I'm not really sure. But if you're a child and you have these chronic, constant, fall-down, crazy seizures that can't be controlled with medications, well, we just might have your answer. In fact, we just might have your answer. It's so good. I would love to see it repeated, because almost no medication does what this medication did for seizures. But I don't want to spoil it. So here we go, Joe and I talking about this brand new drug and the trial that got it there. Here we go, true or false, last article. This is actually, to me, the most interesting one.
Really? You like this one the most?
Yeah, I love it. I do. I find it fascinating because it's the beginning of evidence. And it's the beginning of evidence, well, a trend in evidence on the effect of cannabidiol on drop seizures in the Lennox-Gastaut. I don't even know what this is. Syndrome.
You learned about this in med school. This is so a step one, step two question. So these Lennox-Gastaut syndrome is kind of a spectrum disease. We don't really understand it very well. It is characterized by mental retardation along with multiple different types of seizures. Not all of them have the same types, and for sure some have more severe. For example, maybe they have more focal, but then some of them have more generalized. They'll have both in one patient, and those different types of seizures, including drop seizures, make patients more or less complicated based on severity, duration, frequency, all that kind of stuff for any other simple or any other seizure patient. This is a big group, though, of poorly understood patients. And now we have a study. Like you said, it's the beginning of evidence. So what did you like about the study, Andrew?
I mean, we're using what everyone wants to work. And I know everyone wants to, it to work because the way they adjusted their placebo. And I'll let you talk about that. But we used what people want to work, and it actually worked. So that's fantastic.
That's true. So they took in people between 2 and 55 years of age. And for the kids, they would talk to the parents and say, we have a, you know, to kind of not be blinded, whatever, we have a byproduct of marijuana we'd like to try, and or a placebo. We won't tell you what you get. And the parents were all super jazzed. They'd all been waiting for it and hoping for this, I guess, to the point that they, before the study even started, they accounted for a 17% placebo benefit because of the bias of the parent hoping that this is the right drug.
So let's talk about that for a second, because that's my favorite part of the study. Deal. They said placebo is basically going to work one out of every five times. It's placebo, but it's going to work one out of every five times. And we're talking about for seizures, it's going to be beneficial one out of every five times just because the parents or the person wants it to work so badly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a huge community bias towards marijuana byproducts or derivatives in healthcare. We want it to work so bad. We believe it will work. We believe there's some conspiracy holding it from us, or maybe it's just a lack of research, and this is the beginning of that research. And it does show a 41% reduction after patients were already on between 1 and 4 titrated and well-tolerated anti-epileptic drugs. So we give them the best we have. We give them the best drugs for their seizure type. And then we still get a 40% reduction in drop seizures by adding 20 mg per kg of cannabidiol. Wow.
Insane.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's a great
beginning. But it worked. And yeah, they're on medications, and then it actually did work. And even with the bias, it worked. And it worked at a good rate.
Yeah, I would take 41% reduction in any disease state of the actual disease. So they're having drop seizures. They take this. They have 41% fewer drop seizures. Man, heart attacks. If we had a drug that we gave that reduced heart attacks by 41%, absolutely. Oh, boom. Man. Forget about
boom.
It.
Boom. Forget about it is right. Forget about it is right. All right. What? That's I think all we got. Now, that really was all that we had, and we wrapped it up shortly thereafter. However, I think Joe maybe summarized it best, and it's probably why I like that study so much, is that they accounted for 1 in 5 of the patients in the placebo arm. They were getting placebo. Accounted for them to have improved seizures. And they were pretty much right. They had improved seizures 1 out of every 5 times just because they wanted to believe so bad that they had improved seizures with this cannabidiol medication. Or marijuana medication, as probably better known to most of our patients. But if we had any medication that did anything like improve heart attacks, and the patients were already on other therapies that we, you know, seem to think improve heart attacks, such as statins, which these patients were on other seizure medications, this would be blockbuster. And I think that this probably is blockbuster. I'm eager for more information. You'll always hear it here first on Questioning Medicine, but this is good stuff. So until next time, hopefully until actually next week when we get back to just doing quick hit article reviews, keep the quest and questioning.